The following program from the North Carolina Reading Service is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. This is Indie Week. I'm John Feddersen, and I'm reading this week's issue. It's dated November the 17th of 2022. And as always, I read from both the print and the online editions, and I'll begin this week's with a few online articles. First, some great news from the Durham Public Schools. Just 1 week after residents voted to approve a bond referendum of $423 million for Durham Public Schools, the historically underfunded school district has received another boost in the form of an unsolicited $18 million grant from the billionaire philanthropist Mackenzie Scott. The grant is a drop in the bucket for Scott, who has given away already more than $14 billion since her 2019 divorce from Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, but a wealth of resources for DPS, whose administrators yesterday announced they will work in tandem with school board members to prioritize the use of the funds. As Indy previously reported, the district plans to use the majority of its bond referendum money to fund much-needed repairs for existing schools and to back the construction of a new elementary school and new Durham School of the Arts campus. Bettina Umstead, chair of DPS Board of Education, said in a release, "I want to thank Ms. Scott for witnessing and supporting the great work of DPS educators and staff to support students and families. We will focus on using this to enhance our work with schools that will ignite the limitless potential of our students." And next, an article by Shelby Harris, also online. North Carolina voter turnout in 2022 was lower than 2018, despite many predicting the opposite. Roughly 53% of eligible voters in North Carolina went to the polls during the 2018 midterms. This year, the percentage fell from 53 to 51%. Despite expert predictions that voters would break turnout records in the 2022 general election, North Carolinians cast fewer ballots November 18th than in 2018. According to the State Board of Elections, roughly 53% went to the polls during 2018. This year, about 51%. The dip in turnout comes 2 years after the election in which North Carolinians cast the most ballots cast ever since at least 1972. Roughly 75% of eligible voters, more than 5.5 million, voted in that 2020 general election. That's a larger percentage than general elections from 1972 to 2016, when voter turnout ranged between 58 and 68%. In an article published October 22nd, political analyst Nathan Gonzalez described former President Trump as the turnout engine for the 2018 and 2020 elections, meaning Trump inspired masses of voters to turn up to vote either for or against him. Gonzalez and other political researchers predicted that the U.S. Supreme Court's overturning of Roe v. Wade, a ruling that gave states the power to restrict abortion access, would inspire great numbers of voters. While voters in many states voted in favor, in most cases, on abortion rights, Roe v. Wade did not have the predicted outcome on voter turnout. Only 10 states saw higher voter turnout percentages in 2022, an analysis by the Washington Post shows. The remaining states, including North Carolina, didn't keep the voting momentum that researchers predicted. Low voter turnout did not sway North Carolina from keeping to its Republican patterns, electing Republican Ted Budd to the U.S. Senate. The reason for the drop in voter turnout in the Tar Heel state will be difficult to identify until the state releases demographic voter data, which will be released within a few weeks, according to the state, which will reveal trends in voter age, race, ethnicity, and affiliation. A likely cause of the decrease could be voter apathy or lack of trust in the government and its processes, as NPR discovered just after the 2018 election. North Carolina voters expressed similar sentiments in a Carolina Public Press survey asking unaffiliated voters to tell their reasons for registering as such. But some voter groups, such as those ages 18 through 29 that are typically considered to be politically apathetic or not engaged or not interested in government, are not expected to have voted on November 8th. A Tufts University study predicts 27% of Americans in this age group voted Tuesday. That's the second highest percentage of young voters since 1994, falling just behind the record 31% in 2018. During the 2020 election, 60% of registered voters from age 18 to 25 voted, and 65% age 26 through 40 voted, according to the Board of Elections. The groups accounted for about 11% of total North Carolina voters that year. Another voter group anticipated to take to the polls in large number is North Carolina's Latino population. In April, the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials predicted that the 2022 Latino and Hispanic voter turnout would be 94% higher than in 2014. Analysts credit the surge in registration among Latino voters who typically vote Democrat to the election of Trump. The CEO of the NALEO, Arturo Vargas, wrote in April, "The actual Latino vote could well exceed this projection if candidates and parties invest in meaningful outreach efforts to engage the community from the start." State Board of Elections election data from 2020 showed 59% of registered Latino and Hispanic voters cast ballots. In total, Hispanic and Latino votes made up roughly 2% of total voters in 2020. Other trends of demographic data will be available in the next month or so, said Board of Elections spokesperson Patrick Gannon. He emailed Carolina Public Press on November 10th saying, "We're not able to compile that chart until all 100 counties finalize their voter histories, which typically takes several weeks after the election. Until then, it's difficult to draw conclusions about which, if any, voter groups ushered North Carolina into its new Republican state leadership." Yet another online article now from Trista Talton. Understaffed North Carolina Environmental Agency is stretched to the limit. As of October 25th, 340 of 1,800 positions in the Department of Environmental Quality were vacant, including new time-limited positions created to administer federal funding programs. This article was originally published on CoastalReview.org. Nearly one-fifth of the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality job positions are unfilled, leaving the agency responsible for administering regulations to protect water, air quality, and the public's health in a tight pinch that's not likely to loosen anytime soon. As of October 25th, 19% of positions in DEQ were vacant. That includes new time-limited positions. DEQ staffing shortage is indicative of a broader issue in state government where a number of departments are dealing with even steeper declines, putting the squeeze on state employees who are left to pick up the slack while typically making less than their professional counterparts in the private sector. State government job vacancies were up more than 22% by the end of August. The employee void is hitting every state government sector, from public schools to safety to health and human services, all while billions of dollars are tucked away, unappropriated, in reserve accounts. unless legislators pump some of those funds to state agencies to ensure employees are paid at rates competitive with the private sector, unfilled job positions may rise, deepening a void that's already being felt by those the government is here to serve, you. Compounding the loss of staff to higher-paying private jobs is the number of retirement-eligible staff within the department since January the 1st. 53 DEQ employees have retired. Another 14% of the employees are eligible for retirement, says DEQ Deputy Secretary for Public Affairs Sharon Martin in an email. Within the next 5 years, 450 employees will be eligible for retirement. And she said, that's another reason why we are so focused on addressing recruitment and retention issues. But that's no easy task in what she describes as a highly competitive labor market, exacerbated by the inability to compete with market salaries. In fact, 36% of employees who have quit the department say salary was a factor in their decision to leave. More than half, 56% of job offers were declined based on pay, according to information Martin provided. She said, at DEQ's current funding levels, many budgeted salaries are not competitive in the current job market, and engineers may be one of the clearest examples. Among state agencies, DEQ has the second highest need for engineers, behind only the Department of Transportation. However, market competition for engineers makes retention and recruitment particularly difficult. The average and median salary for DEQ Engineer 1 is about $15,000 less than the starting salary of an NC State University engineer graduate. An Engineer 2 with more than 20 years' experience is paid roughly the equivalent to a fresh out of college State University engineer graduate. Martin said DEQ is taking several steps to address staffing challenges, such as bumping up salaries for 88 employees whose pay was below the minimum under the state's compensation system, targeting retention bonuses for engineer and environmental specialists, and evaluating a multi-step department-wide plan to narrow the public-private sector pay gap for staff who meet certain education and experience qualifications. When real wages for state employees are not keeping up with the private sector and inflation, now at a 41-year high, that makes it incredibly difficult to retain, quote, the kind of dedicated, talented, and knowledgeable public servants we rely on to make modern life possible, said Patrick McHugh, research manager at the North Carolina Budget and Tax Center. I think for all that we've heard about the challenges that private employers are experiencing with hiring people, there's been incredibly little attention paid to a similar crisis that's playing out among public sector employees, specifically state employees. McHugh said he first saw a disparity between the loss of state, federal, and local government employees when he examined data released by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. According to that data, North Carolina has lost thousands of state employees, but that's not the case in local or federal government sectors. Questioning whether he was looking at erroneous data, McHugh cross-referenced the Bureau's numbers with that of the North Carolina Office of State Human Resources, and the results were the same. McHugh said, one of the important things to keep in mind when talking about the current decline of state employees is the pandemic. Crises like the pandemic that descended on America in early 2020 unveiled weaknesses in government. Years before the pandemic, DEQ was one of the chief targets of cuts and underfunding under the administration of Governor Pat McCrory, who was governor from 2013 to 2017. McHugh said, even though the proportional decrease for DEQ employees may not be as severe as some other parts of state government, the fact they were already barely keeping things together because years of cuts means that those kinds of losses can be even more severe than just the pure job numbers may indicate. It's been 5 years since per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAs, were thrust into the spotlight in North Carolina after the public was made aware that the man-made chemicals have been discharged into the Cape Fear River, the air, the ground for decades by DuPont spinoff Chemours. The PFAS crisis overlays other long-term issues like the impacts of climate change, further exacerbating limited staff resources, McHugh said. When those sorts of things happen, that pulls capacity away from other priorities within an institution like DEQ, and when an institution like DEQ is already stretched to the limit, that means that other important priorities like climate change, like other kinds of water protection, like other kinds of environmental protection, has to be sacrificed to address the new challenge that has just arisen. For DEQ staff, that means more work and longer hours. Martin said the result is longer lead times on some permitting processes and increased stress on our staff. Chris Gibson, president of the Wilmington Civil Engineering Company, TI Coastal Services, Inc., noticed the squeeze on DEQ employees starting around the time Hurricane Florence hit the North Carolina coast in 2018. The storm's record-breaking storm surge topped 9 to 13 feet and produced catastrophic flooding in coastal and near-coastal island counties. Gibson said, "It's progressively getting worse. I say this, and if you're going to quote me on anything, this is not the fault of staff. It's the fact there's not enough staff for the amount of stuff that's going on. We've been in a big rebuilding scenario on the coast, and we're still running with the same number of staff or less. We've had so much work that's come up from them from the hurricanes. I mean, how many crosswalks has Jason Dale had to look at in the past 5 years?" Dale's a field officer with DEQ's Division of Coastal Management's Wilmington Regional Office. Gibson said if a state asks for a 70-day extension to review a permit, it usually takes the full 75 days because something more urgent gets into the works. They rarely ask for an extension and then give you a permit 3 days later. You can expect whatever the time they've asked for is the time before it's going to get to you, so it's tough. It's really tough. We've got from November 15th to the end of March or April, depending on exactly what the job is. If we're trying to get a permit in September and all of a sudden there's another 75 days put on it, we're thinking 60 days ahead, and now we're 20 days behind. So all of a sudden, I'm stuck with staffing needs or holes in my staffing, or I'm overstaffed because things have to shift. It hits us in so many different ways. Dana Sargent, executive director of Cape Fear River Watch, expressed frustration about the staff shortages, saying, "Environmental nonprofits are also overwhelmed, working with limited staff and funding." She said, "I feel there's a lot of great people at DEQ doing great things. I appreciate the recent work coming out of the DEQ on PFAS is strong, and I'm very much grateful for that work. That being said, it's their job. They absolutely need more money. There's huge amounts of pollution in our state we're trying to protect our communities from, and we're doing all we can on limited funding, also begging for grants, and then having to prove to our grantors what we're doing to spend our capital on that. So it's frustrating to hear from a state agency that they just don't have the funds, while we're scraping our funds to do this work." In late September, the North Carolina Tax and Budget Center released a report highlighting the 22-23 state budget's failures to address the effects of inflation. Though the state economy is robust, state spending relative to the economy is at an all-time low, according to the report. Rather than use federal COVID relief funding funneled to the state to address the pandemic crisis, state legislatures essentially used those funds for things typically paid for by state dollars and diverted state funds to reserves. And they did this without giving North Carolina residents the opportunity to voice their opinions, whether it be through committee hearings or through their elected representatives voting on the floor. Instead, the House and Senate chambers released their conference report on the budget, Amendments cannot be made in a conference report, and the report cannot be referred to a committee. Legislators transferred $9 billion to more than a dozen reserve accounts in fiscal 22-23. Nearly $4.2 billion of those are unappropriated, including $1 billion placed in a newly created Stabilization and Inflation Reserve. McHugh said, I think it's important for the residents of North Carolina to know that we have billions of dollars sitting on the sidelines in a moment of ongoing crisis, and that is just something not enough conversation has been had about. Just stop the bleeding. The reality is we have the money in hand right now to give the kinds of raises that would at least insulate public servants from the effects of inflation. It'll take years to rebuild the capacity in DEQ and other parts of state government that we have lost. A couple of briefer articles now from IndyWeek.com. Wake County leaders have changed the firearms ordinance in unincorporated Wake County for the first time in two decades. The new ordinance, approved November 9 by county commissioners, includes new provisions that prohibit the discharge of a firearm on a public street or highway or between the hours of 10 p.m. and 7 a.m. The amended ordinance also prohibits firing a gun within 300 yards of another residence or occupied building without written permission. That distance was previously set at 100 yards. In addition, the ordinance will require gun owners to fire into a backstop that meets specifications recognized by a nationally recognized firearms safety organization, and this new ordinance goes into effect December 9th. Zig Hutchinson, chair of the Wake County Board of Commissioners, said the amended ordinance was for the safety of all our residents in Wake County, and it was driven by growth within the county. Hutchinson said in a statement, we're thankful for the thoughtful input from gun owners and others, including the Wake County Sheriff's Office, whose deputies will enforce this ordinance. Violating the ordinance is a Class 3 misdemeanor and is punishable by a fine of up to $500 or 30 days in jail. Hunting regulations, though, in Wake County will not be affected by changes to the ordinance, as they are regulated by state and federal law. Now, in our print version, and I guess online too, Jasmine Gallup has gathered together all of the projects that are going to be covered by the new City of Raleigh Parks Bond and the Wake County Schools Bond and the Wake Tech Bond, all of which recently passed by considerable margins in the recent election. So while voters elected some new faces, they also approved new construction. They total more than $1 billion in new funding. Collectively, the bonds mark a significant investment. Now, here's what that money will buy. Now, there's a big ring chart that which I can't describe for you, but I'll just run quickly down, as quickly as I can, a list of, really, the shopping list for this. The Parks Bond passed with 73% approval. It'll heavily supported by Mayor Baldwin and the current City Council will fund 20 projects, including ones to improve inner-city green space and some long-overlooked and underfunded parks in historically African-American neighborhoods. It'll also pay for long-anticipated greenway connections so people can more easily bike and walk through Raleigh. A large chunk is going to go through a new play plaza in Dorothea Dix Park. Dix Park, one part of a multi-step plan to improve that park. So here we go. I'm going to round off all of these numbers, although they're already rounded off pretty well for me. 11 for the park projects, almost $100 million. $11.5 million, Devereaux Meadows restoration and improvements. $7 million, Erinsbrook Park implementation. $4.5 million, Green Road Park improvements. $54 million, John Chavis Historic Park expansion and improvements. $9 million, Kyle Drive Neighborhood Park Planning and Development. $11.5 million to Neuse River Park Planning and Development, and $2 million to the Strickland and Leesville Road Park Improvements. Then we have community center projects, almost $15 million. Method Community Center Improvements, $15 million. Sertoma Arts Center Improvements, $12 million. John Top Green Center Improvements, and the construction of the South Park Heritage Walk, and $30 million to the Tarboro Community Center Redevelopment. We have bike and pedestrian projects, $21 million for Lake Wheeler Road, bike and pedestrian path and other improvements, and $5 million for construction of walkable and bikeable connections to city parks and greenways. And how about those greenways? $4.5 million to the Crabtree Creek Greenway to Sandy Forks Road connection. Almost $4 million to Lake Lynn Trail Loop. $3.3 million Marsh Creek Greenway planning and design. $5.5 million Mine Creek Greenway improvements, and $10 million to Walnut Creek Greenway improvements. And other projects into this bond include $7 million for the Biltmore Hills Tennis Complex expansion, and $43 million for the aforementioned construction of Dix Park Gibson Play Plaza. All right, then we have the Wake County Schools Bond, and that was $531 million. Overwhelming approval. 71% of voters cast ballots in favor. The county's aging buildings, some 30 or 40 years old, are in critical need of repair. So, associated construction costs got $51 million, including $1 million permit fees, $2.5 million environmental concerns, $5.7 million temporary classrooms, $21 million program management, and $20 million program contingency. Furniture replacement will cost $4.5 million, and educational equipment, almost $8 million. How about these aging school renovations? Here's the list of them to be improved. The aging renovations, $5.5 million to Brentwood Elementary, all the same to Briarcliff Elementary, $11 million Lockhart Elementary, $5.5 million Washington Elementary, $7.3 million Ligon Middle, $52 million to North Garner Middle, $5 million to Athens Drive High, and $75 million district-wide for HVAC, boiler, and other building infrastructure renewal and replacement. $27 million partial renovations and improvements. This is for all the district. New school projects. They're almost $274 million. Broken down this way. $60 for the Bowling Road Elementary in Fuquay. $60 to the Pleasant Plains Elementary in Apex. $5.5 million for Wendell Elementary in Wendell. $8 million for unnamed high school yet in West Cary, Morrisville. And $141 million for the Parkside Middle and Wake Early College of Information and Biotech in Morrisville. New building construction, $300 million thusly, $105 for the Health Sciences Building and Parking Deck, $76 million Business University Transfer Building, $54 million Life Sciences Biotech Building, $65 million Cyber Science Building and Parking Deck. And finally, now I'll have to say, all of those, I just went to another ring chart without even noticing I had gone to the Wake Tech Bond. That $300 million for new building construction is the Wake Tech Bond, and all those three, four projects I gave were for Wake Tech, and these building renovations are as well. I apologize. $38 million for Southern Wake campus buildings and facilities, and $15,600,000 to repairs, renovations, and infrastructure upgrades across all Wake Tech campuses. So that covers the three bond issues that were passed in Wake County. And you can peruse these, read more about them, a little more detailed, and not much more, in IndieWeek.com. Also from Jasmine Gallup in a Raleigh art-based article, The New Guard. This is Raleigh's four newly elected city council members. That council saw a major power shift on election day with four political newcomers voted into office. But while these women may want to move the council in a slightly different direction, they're all prepared to tackle the city's biggest issues right away, from affordable housing to community engagement. The new council, which is now a 6-2 majority women, is set to start the work of governing next year following the induction of those new members next month. Broadly speaking, there are two main factions, the incumbents, who campaigned to stay the course, and the newcomers, who pushed for a more transparent council with better engagement with residents. Well, the council is now evenly split between these two groups, meaning that despite winning a bid for re-election, Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin is likely to face more pushback in the coming months. The council is also likely to divide more on some issues. Some votes could depend on a single outlying member. On one hand, there are incumbents Baldwin, Stormy Forte, Jonathan Milton, and Corey Branch, who remain, with Forte taking an at-large seat. On the other, there are newcomers Mary Black Branch, representing District A, Megan Patton, District B, Jane Harrison, District D, and Christina Jones, District E. The new cohort is one of the youngest in history, a group of professional women who say they want to change things for the better. The first time they saw each other after Election Day at an Indie Week photo shoot in Brentwood Park, shouts of congratulations filled the air and hugs were shared all around. Their conversation was like among a group of friends. Exchanges about the best calendar app to use, an unlucky car accident, and midnight phone calls from reporters. Black Branch was finishing up a video chat on her phone when she stepped out of her car. She said, "We've been supporting each other for months." She added, "Her fellow newly elected council members feel like family now." One major trait the newbies have in common is their attitude toward community engagement. During the election cycle, each said the city needs to do better, engaging residents and responding to their concerns. Clearly, the message resonated with voters. The debate over community engagement began when the city council abruptly dismantled citizens' advisory councils, the CACs, in 2020, arguing they were an archaic and ineffective system for communicating residents' concerns. Of course, the city's 18 CACs varied widely, with some representing tens of thousands of households along large geographic areas, and some representing just a few thousand in a handful of neighborhoods. Baldwin and other council members argued CACs were not representative of the city's diverse population. In-person meetings often occurred on weekday evenings, which meant not everyone could participate. People who attended CAC meetings also held a wide variety of concerns, from zoning and development to worries about food deserts. Food deserts, education, and crime, noted Mickey Fern, the consultant hired to study community engagements for the city. But the role that CACs played in guiding development was likely the overarching factor in the city's decision to abolish them. The groups didn't meet just to discuss community issues. Residents could use them to loudly oppose and sometimes stall new proposed development projects. Before defunding, CACs could cast votes on proposed rezoning. The Raleigh Planning Commission then considered those votes before making a non-binding recommendation to the council. Since the dissolving of the CACs, the city has been slow to create a new system of public outreach, and many Raleighites say they feel ignored. Now, we may see the return of CACs, albeit in a modified form. Harrison and Jones each say they want to see the groups refunded and reformed with changes to promote citywide engagement and improve representation of Raleigh's diverse population. Jones, the current and longest-serving chairperson of the overseeing Raleigh Citizens Advisory Council, RCAC, says she doesn't feel bitter or frustrated about the ways the CACs were sidelined. The result of the election speak for themselves, she said. And she says, it's really going to be impressed upon the incumbent council and mayor to say, are you open for the change? Are you open for the discussion? Because we all know Raleigh is changing and growing, and no one wants to stop that. I just want to make sure that we're all a part of it. Jones says she's willing to deny CACs the power to vote on new projects if it will help bring back regular community meetings. Quote, one concern I heard on the campaign trail was like, oh, the CACs are voting on residents' property rights. And while I vehemently disagree because their vote was never binding, I understand that we have to compromise. So if the vote is what makes people not want to participate in CACs, then take the vote. We haven't had one for 3 years. Take it away, but bring the developers in to give the information. Give us a path to understand where our feedback goes so that we know our voice is heard. Jones, Harrison, and Patton propose creating more groups that represent smaller areas, potentially using the city's 28 community centers as bases of operation. Black Branch wants to see other changes to community engagement, namely using a hybrid model for meetings so people can attend virtually, an idea Harrison also supports. In addition, Harrison wants to provide better outreach and communication tools to CACs so they can reach more people. She says, I want CAC leaders to have access to leadership training, as well as term limits to encourage new leaders, including young people and renters. Meeting facilitation, agenda setting, having a structured process of engagement, those are skills that we need. I'd even like to encourage groups to meet that go beyond a specific neighborhood. For example, communities like the unhoused or homeless, who would also benefit from regular interaction with city staff and leaders. My guess is that everyone on council in this next term believes Raleigh is better off when neighbors communicate, organize, and advocate to address issues of common concern. Patton takes a softer stance on CACs, saying she does support reconstituting some form of a neighborhood meeting, but the CACs aren't the be-all and end-all. The city can learn from politicians who are already doing well with community engagement, such as U.S. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who regularly hosts Ask Me Anything live discussions on Reddit and Instagram. Most people Patton encountered along the campaign trail weren't involved in the firestorm over land use, she says. They simply wanted to know how to get speed bumps on their road and when the city was going to fix that stoplight on the corner. She says, I was a person who wasn't served by CACs. I recognize their limitations. We should view CACs as what they are, which is one component of community engagement. With CACs maybe on their way back, many Raleigh residents are worried that the city council will reverse course to the past when it was more difficult for the city to enact zoning changes. For years, critics say the council's approach to zoning privileged traditional neighborhoods and left renters and lower-income families with no place to live. Jones objects to that characterization and says she's not serving on the council to stop growth. Quote, just to open the door to have more people at the table. In her view, the conversation around affordable housing needs to include residents' voices more prominently. As the city grows and builds more densely, Jones says there is real room to ask developers to include more affordable housing. While inclusionary zoning is not permitted under state law, the council could more proactively lobby for change. Council members could also start more conversations with developers about including affordable housing, Jones says, adding that she's seen developers compromise with the council on projects that were initially market rate. She says, I see the bending. How far can we go in asking developers to bend a bit more? I think there is room for that, especially when you have a council who is there to support that cause. For the last 3 years, it's been rubber stamping and allowing developers to do whatever they want. I want a council that's going to ask those questions about affordable housing. While Jones campaigned on keeping developers in check, Harrison, Patton, and Blanche, Black Branch took a less confrontational stance. Each of them agrees in part with the current city council's approach to addressing the affordable housing shortage, but in their view, the city council could do much more. Harrison, Raleigh needs a bold, comprehensive housing affordability plan that engages those directly impacted by rapidly rising costs of living. We ought to craft a plan in conversation with residents across the city that considers policies like property tax abatement, utility relief for low-income homeowners, and preservation of naturally occurring affordable housing. During their campaigns, Harrison and others promised to address citizens' concerns about the disappearance of naturally occurring affordable housing, displacement and gentrification, and rising property taxes. Harrison also says she wants to do more to stabilize rents, preventing huge annual increases that often force people out of their homes. She says the city should take a harder look at inclusionary zoning as well as tenant protections to prevent evictions and provide real location assistance. The current city council has already embraced some of these policies. With the $80 million affordable housing bond approved in 2020, the council has funded initiatives, including land purchases along transit corridors, affordable housing construction in partnership with nonprofits, and down payment assistance. But incoming council members say these projects could use more funding and support. Patton, there are some strategies in light rotation that I'd like to put in heavy rotation. We need to double down on preserving existing affordable housing. Property tax relief for tax-burdened residents has been ticking along in Wake County, but I want our residents to feel the benefits of that. With two professional environmentalists now taking seats on the council, Mary Black Branch, an environmental activist, and Jane Harrison, a coastal economic specialist, plans to address climate change could be at the forefront next year. Baldwin has asked Harrison to chair the Growth and Natural Resource Committee for the City Council, Harrison says. Quote, the first issue I want to tackle is stronger tree protections for Raleigh. Raleigh should institute protections for native species of a certain size and create a tree fund when protection isn't feasible. Trees help clean and cool the air, clean stormwater, reduce erosion, and add immense value to our city and neighborhoods. We need those safeguards in place to protect our tree canopy. So, it's something relatively simple, but it actually takes care of a lot of different issues. Black Branch also plans to push the city council forward on climate change, she says. She wants to take a look at ways local government can intercede to reduce carbon emissions as well as regulate development. Quote, I've been meeting with climate advocates and climate scientists about the ways we can put some teeth and grit into how we're focusing on emissions and reductions. I'm trying to figure out ways we can actually do climate action on a real fundamental and proactive level, and not something that's in text. Moreover, she wants to mitigate negative impacts that development can have on the environment, as well as reduce environmental injustice. Raleigh's massive growth, which sometimes involves clear-cutting trees, can exacerbate flash flooding and stormwater runoff. Often these impacts are felt most by historically marginalized people and minorities. She says, that heavy rain we had over the weekend, oh man, so many parts of Six Forks flooded and it only rained hard there for an hour. Imagine if we got a really bad storm like we've had in the past. It's completely possible, and we're not well equipped for that. She plans to look at ways to incentivize developers to build green, as well as invest in community solar. Patton is also looking forward to tackling sustainability, she says. Her priorities speak to the desires of many younger Raleighites who want to do their part to protect the environment, but often can't afford to buy an electric car or install solar panels on the roof, for example. Patton says she wants to look at ways to incentivize landlords to operate more sustainably, and that transit is also a huge component of sustainability. She says big projects like commuter rail are already ticking along, but don't have a timeline of a decade. They have a timeline of a decade. We don't have time for them to move along at a glacial pace. I don't say that lightly, because I know interagency cooperation is a slow process, but residents want to see public transportation now. And the next hard news article, A Bitter Choice, by Adejuan Ojibwa. Judge Amanda Maris rocked her gray chair back and forth at the mahogany bench in her courtroom where she was hearing cases involving domestic violence. On this October morning at the Durham County Courthouse, only two people sat in the gallery. The metal hinges of the courtroom door suddenly unlatched. A short brunette with red highlights entered and speed-walked up to a table where the accuser typically sits, followed by her grandmother. The brunette, named Amy, sported a denim outfit, and the grandmother wore a faded paisley blouse. Amy was seeking a temporary protective order against her ex-boyfriend. She didn't show up with an attorney, and none would arrive. An office assistant, desperately hoping to ultimately win a full protective order, she didn't want to represent herself, but she essentially had no choice. Domestic violence cases involve both criminal and civil proceedings. The criminal proceedings are pursued by the district attorney's office under charges such as aggravated assault. That must cause seriously bodily injury or involve a gun or a knife. As of early October, the Durham police had received 160 complaints of domestic aggravated assaults this year. Those victims may also file protective orders or custody petitions to protect children from an alleged abuser. Those proceedings are civil court hearings, which means that in Amy's case, she was technically the plaintiff. But unlike in criminal court here, there is no constitutional requirement for a lawyer. Many low-income victims in Durham, unable to hire private attorneys, turned to legal aid of North Carolina's Durham office. In three or four civil cases in the United States, one side is not represented by a lawyer. That's three of four civil cases. Legal aid is the primary source of free civil advice for domestic violence survivors because of its partnership with the Durham Crisis Response Center, which provides services to survivors of domestic violence and human trafficking. Michelle Archer, director of the Family Justice Center at the DCRP, says, "Legal Aid have a committed team that we trust with our most vulnerable survivors." The Durham office handles roughly 30 to 60 domestic violence cases a month, accepting about 90% of those referred to it by the DCRC, the police department, and other community partners, according to Gigi Warner, Legal Aid's domestic violence and family law supervising attorney. 10% are typically turned away because Legal Aid doesn't have enough lawyers to represent them. At the same time, many domestic violence victims are unaware of Legal Aid's services. Combined, scores of low-income survivors of domestic violence in Durham end up pursuing their cases without a lawyer. Amy was supposed to arrive at 10 a.m. for the temporary order proceeding. She arrived at 10:46. She and her grandmother sat at the plaintiff's table. The defendant never showed up. Ex parte hearings, which is what this was, grant temporary protective orders, usually up to 10 days until a final hearing. The defendant does not need to attend the initial hearing, but must be present at the final one, at which the judge decides whether to grant a full protective order. Amy navigated this process with some guidance from the DCRC, but she couldn't get a legal aid lawyer. She's among the 10% who didn't make the cut. The courtroom clerk swore Amy in while her grandmother rubbed her back. Maris flipped through a folder and gently asked, "What led you to file this protective order request today?" She said, Amy said, sitting next to the empty defendant's chair, "On multiple occasions, the defendant put his hands on me. The most recent time scared me the most." By the way, this paper is not fully identifying Amy in order to protect her safety. "That time was in June," Amy told the court. She and her then-boyfriend were driving home from Food Lion one afternoon when they started arguing about late utility bills. By the time they arrived at his home, where Amy also lived, they were yelling. "It got more loud, and I was afraid he was going to hit me, so I went into the bathroom," she said, "but he followed me." They scuffled, and she hit her elbow on the bathroom wall. She ended up in a corner of the bathroom, so I put my hands out like this. She threw both arms straight out from her chest to demonstrate. As she continued her account, her voice broke. Amy said the defendant threw her on a bed and punched her as she cried. He called her a stupid bitch, she recalled, as he struck her petite frame. She lay in the fetal position. "When he stopped punching me," Amy said, "he just sat down in a chair watching me cry." The police charged him with assault on a female, which carries a sentence of up to 150 days in prison. Amy moved in with her grandmother, but Amy said her ex-boyfriend incessantly called and texted her. He even showed up at her grandmother's house. Amy said, her shoulders folded, "I thought it was over when I moved out, but he won't leave me alone." That's how she ended up in domestic violence court. Amy's ex-boyfriend is free, awaiting his criminal trial in February, and Amy said she fears more harassment, which is why she filed this protective order. Archer of the DCRC says, "We encourage survivors to file in civil court because it's an extra protective cushion. The order would force Amy's ex to stay at least 100 yards away from her. If he doesn't, he could spend up to 150 days in jail." The DCRC referred Amy to legal aid in Durham, but her case was selected only for a one-time consult. Legal aid does not comment on specific cases, but Warner did say staffing constraints pose a challenge. Quote, "When our staff lawyers reach the number of cases they can attentively handle in a month, there's not much more we can do besides one-time consultation." Amy had her consultation before the October hearing. Legal aid staff told her how to describe the incident to the judge, provide as much detail as possible. They also assured her that 9 out of 10 temporary orders are approved. That's not the case with full protective orders. In 2017, for instance, North Carolina judges approved only 34% of them. Many cases were dismissed because plaintiffs didn't return for their final hearing. In some cases, they didn't have a lawyer to remind them of court dates. Maris granted Amy the temporary order, and a final hearing was scheduled for a week later. In that proceeding, Amy would have to use evidence to show, not just tell Maris, why her ex-boyfriend should be ordered to leave her alone for 1 year. She would have to navigate judicial rules of procedure and perhaps even negotiate with the defendant if he wanted to agree to the order without a trial. That's a tall order for someone who is not an attorney. Lawyers are expensive. Charles Ullman, a Raleigh attorney, who partly specializes in domestic violence cases, charges $120 an hour, which he says is on the cheaper end. These cases are pretty much always messy, which means you get to talk to neighbors, family, friends, or any potential witnesses. That takes a lot of hours. It takes 6 hours for Amy to make $120 from her office assistant job. Amy wasn't likely to get the help of a lawyer. Her best bet was to seek support from third-year law students at Duke University, Chapel Hill, or NC Central, who assist legal aid with domestic violence cases. Some nonprofits provide one-time legal consults but can't give in-court representations. This left Amy with two options: represent herself or incur debt to hire a private attorney. "I don't know what to do," she said. I'm afraid I will run out of time before even completing much of this last article I'm going to read by Jasmine Gallup called Of Mice and Meows. And it's about a new program in Orange County which helps solve the area's feral cat problem with a simple solution, giving them a job. When Alvin, Simone, and Theodore were found by Orange County Animal Services earlier this year, they were hostile to any human contact. The trio of black cats had to be trapped from a distance using baited cages and catch poles. 8 months later, the change in their behavior is remarkable. On the front porch of a picture-perfect farmhouse in Bear Creek, outside Siler City, Alvin lounges in the sun, while Simone is curled up on her human's lap, enjoying pets and ear scratches. Bill Hengstenberg, who adopted the three cats with his wife Barbara in March, says, "When we got Simone, they actually had to put a blanket over her crate. They said, she's so feral, if you get even close to that crate, she'll scratch you to pieces. It's amazing, the change." Barbara adds, "She was a slicing machine. It took a few weeks, but they love to be wherever we are." As we talk, Alvin nudges up against Bill's shins, clearly wanting attention. The little black cat is already much more social than he was when he first arrived at the Hengstenberg's farmhouse in Bear Creek. Alvin and the other two cats were kept in quarantine at first, per instructions from the animal shelter, but that didn't stop him from launching an escape attempt. At one point, Alvin hid under the stairs, waiting for his chance to climb up the wall and go through a tiny 2-by-4-inch hole near the ceiling, says Barbara. That hole didn't lead out of the barn, just out of the workshop, so the couple was able to recapture him with a laundry basket. Now, he might roam their 7-acre property, but he always comes back for dinner. Alvin and his siblings are clearly a source of constant delight to the Hengstenbergs, and in return, they're treated like royalty. They enjoy canned food, a running water fountain, and a heated and air-conditioned home in the barn. The happy ending is all thanks to a new program in Orange County, dubbed the Working Barn Cat Initiative. And I'll leave you tantalized with that. There's a good bit more of this article, which houses feral cats captured outdoors in barns and other workshops and other where they don't have to socialize as much, and they can chase vermin as they please and get used to people. In any event, John Feddersen has to close this week's version of Indie Week. There's plenty more articles in there, music, drama related, etc. I just don't have time for them. And our thrilling theme music is already drawing to a close. You can hear this program, as well as a back history of about 8 million years worth of Indie Week, on our website, ncreadingservice.org. So thanks for listening this week to Indie Week.